First, we go overseas for the news in Italy. Go ahead, Rome.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Ronius in Rome. Italy and her empire today mourn the death of her most popular flyer and administrator, Marshal Italo Balbo, Governor General of Libya. Tonight I learned from a very authoritative source just how Marshal Balbo met his death in Libya. He was flying from the coastal town of Derna to Tobruk. On an inspection trip, find him with six other Italian officials and three crew members. Arriving over Tobruk, he found himself right in the middle of a British air raid, according to this story. Although Balbo's plane was not trimmed for battle, and in spite of the fact he was carrying more than the plane's ordinary crew, Balbo plunged into the thick of the fighting. But it's not clear just what caused his plane to burst into flames. It's thought, however, that the fire was caused by enemy bullets, or perhaps by bursting shell from anti-aircraft units below. In any case, the flaming plane crashed and Balbo and the other occupants of the plane were killed. And today, flags in Italy fly at half-mast. Fascist monuments and inscriptions were draped in black. Sporting events all over Italy were canceled. Signor Mussolini has decreed that the 30th of June each year shall be a national day of mourning in memory of his friend and fellow fascist. In July 1933, Balbo wrote a new page in aviation history by flying the Atlantic to New York at the head of 24 huge seaplanes carrying 110 men. Many of you probably remember that. I certainly do. New York turned out to greet this smiling, bearded, chain-smoking young Italian in a big way. You may remember his easy, genial manner and the natural, happy way he waved to the cheering crowds as he was driven through the streets to a Lexington Avenue hotel. And always with that inevitable cigarette between his fingers. He once said, "It's good to die fighting in one's prime." Well, he got his wish. Among the others killed in the crash was Enrico Caratti, Consul General of Tripoli, and Balbo's intimate friend. Balbo's nephew, 31-year-old Commandant Lino Balbo, was also among the victims. Today's Italian war communique tells of an increased air fighting on the Cyrenaica and Egyptian frontier. The Italians claim four British planes were shot down. The crews of some of the planes were captured, says the report. It's admitted that two Italian planes failed to return to their home base. During a British air raid on the airfield at Tobruk, that's the place where Marshal Balbo plunged to his death, Italian fighters shot down two enemy bombers. A third British plane was so badly damaged that it probably didn't reach its home base, the bulletin says. Another enemy plane was brought down by anti-aircraft fire when British planes attempted to bomb the airfield at Messala in Italian East Africa, concludes the communique. Another report late tonight claims the Italian destroyer Schifanino attacked an enemy submarine in the Mediterranean with depth charges. The submarine is believed to have been sunk, says this message. Here in Rome, the Romanian situation continues to be somewhat of a mystery. Reports are that Soviet and Russian troops have occupied all the territory agreed to, namely Bessarabia and Bukovina. At one point, the Russians overstepped the boundary fixed and kept right on going into Romania. King Carol's government made a quick protest, and the Soviet troops backed out again, while Foreign Commissar Molotov apologized for what he called an error on the part of one of the Russian generals. Romania is fully mobilized and is said to be ready to resist any territorial grabs by Hungary or Bulgaria. But here in Rome, it's believed unlikely that either of these countries will make any attempt on Romania until Italy and Germany say the word. And that, according to reliable quarters in Rome, won't be until the Axis partners win the war with England. Now, in the meantime, Signor Mussolini continues his inspection of the Alpine frontier. The Duce went into France again and saw more captured French defense works. Reports in Rome are that he intends to visit the entire frontier from Switzerland down to the Mediterranean. Tonight, he and his staff are stopping in a small mountain village in the Lower Alps. This is Charles Lanius in Rome. I now return you to NBC in New York.
Back again in the NBC newsroom in New York, after hearing the first of our NBC staff broadcasters in this program, Charles Lanius, speaking to you from Rome. In just a few moments, we shall go overseas for the next of our international pickups, this time to the other end of the Rome-Berlin axis, to Rundfunk House, the radio city of Germany, in the heart of Berlin. Our monitors have been indicating to us that the Berlin circuit is functioning correctly, and in just a few seconds we shall be able to switch over there and get our signal from the Berlin announcer that our times coincide. Of course, there is a difference of 6 hours between Berlin summertime and Eastern Daylight Saving Time, but apart from that, our second and minute hands must coincide. Since we go over to Berlin on agreed times, arrived at beforehand, and we listen to our Berlin announcer in order to be sure that there is a coincidence between our times. Let's see if we can get the time gong from Berlin right now. The circuit is still there, indicating that Berlin will be on the air at the agreed time. And so now we'll leave the NBC newsroom in New York to go overseas for our broadcast from the German capital. Hello, hello, Berlin. NBC newsroom in New York calling Berlin. Come ahead. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is William C. Kirker calling from Berlin. While political as well as military inactivity seems to prevail, Germany is enjoying a veritable holiday from all the intense excitement of the past weeks. However, the mighty military machine of the Reich is getting ready to deliver that death blow against England. Men and material are being massed along the French, Belgian, and Dutch seacoast in order to strengthen the position which now reaches about England like a giant claw. Of course, there's no telling when Hitler will give orders to start that huge army and air force off an effort to crush England. However, the man of the street in Germany is of the opinion that the war should be started the sooner the better, so that there might be a hope of returning to peace and normalcy. In the meantime, a period seems to be setting in during which small nations in Europe will try to sneak in through the back door of the big power political stage in order to secure their own economic and political interests, now that the Russian-Romanian territorial dispute has been settled the, quote, peaceful way, unquote. For instance, we read of a number of trade agreements which have been signed recently, for instance, between Germany and Finland and Germany and Greece. Exchange trade negotiations have been concluded. Russia, too, has signed an exchange trade agreement with Finland amounting to $50 million worth of exchange trade. And I see that, according to German reports, at the present two Hungarian delegates are in Moscow to effect a trade agreement of some kind. Today in Wiesbaden, at 11 o'clock, the first official session of the Armistice Commission took place. Wiesbaden, as you may know, was also the headquarters of the Armistice Commission in 1919. And now German military officials, to complete the cycle of reversing the, quote, old order of Versailles, unquote, have chosen this lovely city again to work out a basis of putting the armistice terms which were imposed upon France into effect. The German delegation is headed by General von Stutenagel, while General Hunzinger is in charge of the French delegation. At 11 o'clock, the members of the commission were addressed by General von Stutenagel at the Nassauer Hof Hotel in Wiesbaden. A short introduction of various members followed, and then the commission began its discussions in a huge hall decorated with German flags draped about Adolf Hitler's picture. According to information received in Berlin, France, as well as her French colonies, are adhering to the terms of armistice. It is reported that the various colonial armies, and particularly the Syrian army, is being demobilized. While bells continue to chime at noon, Germany is still in jubilant spirits over her recent victory over France. Today, almost all papers carry pictures of Adolf Hitler in Strasbourg, and now Elsass-Lorraine is beginning to figure largely in German front reports appearing in the papers. By the by, there are some unconfirmed rumors about that Hitler has already chosen a governor for Elsass-Lorraine if and when it is re-annexed to the Reich. Beginning tomorrow, July 1st, German automobile owners will no longer be permitted to drive their cars without an insurance. Compulsory automobile insurance amounting to $40,000 personal and liability insurance has been decreed for each and every car owner. It is said that the cost of the insurance is not too high and by all means is in balance with the security which the compulsory insurance law affords German car owners. Hello, NBC. This is William C. Kirker, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company.
We've heard from NBC reporters in Rome and Berlin, the capital cities of the Axis partners. Now let's hear from Great Britain. William Hillman, European Director of Colliers, is our reporter, broadcasting direct from London. Go ahead, Bill Hillman, in London.
This is Bill Hillman, speaking from London. It is 10 minutes past midnight, the dawn of the 303rd day of the war. History's most critical 100 days are just beginning. The fate of Great Britain, therefore the fate of Western Europe, may be decided in those 100 days. If this island fortress can hold out until the October fogs and adverse weather might effectively help check Hitler's plan of conquest, winter and spring will bring new possibilities. The eyes of the world are temporarily shifted to Russia and Romania and the restless cockpit of the Balkans. It is officially announced in Bucharest that clashes have occurred between Russia and Romanian troops. They were due to the speeding up of the Russian advance, which overtook the rear guard of the retiring Romanian force. But the events in the East are not distracting the watchfulness of Great Britain. It is here in the West that the important battle of the century is to be fought. Hitler's plans to strike at England at any moment now, Mr. Chamberlain warns Britain. Informed circles say that the attack is likely before July the 9th. With a frankness of advance notice as fantastic as the speed of his thrusts, the conqueror who has already outstripped Napoleon says he will force Great Britain to its knees by August the 15th. Hitler has 46 days in which to make good. Stalin's bad table manners and grabbing off more from the Romanian dish than he told Hitler he would take are alleged to have upset the Führer. It is even said this upset may delay Germany's action against Britain. It seems strange that anyone believes this. Hitler may not like Stalin's appetite, nor Stalin look with admiration on Hitler's capacity to devour, but they will not quarrel between themselves at this stage over their respective hunger for territory. Neither Berlin nor Moscow feel able now to make war on the other. Their relations are based on a cynical admixture of suspicion and surface friendship. This friendship suffices their present plans to partition Europe. Should Great Britain be conquered, Hitler knows anything on the continent from the Atlantic to the Siberian wastes is his for the taking. This fortress isle is the last citadel in Western Europe blocking his ambitions. A lightning attack on Ireland can be expected at any time. It might be launched simultaneously with an attempted invasion of Britain. Hitler may hit at Southern Ireland first. With Southern Ireland and the entire European continental coast from Norway to Spain and Germany's control, Britain would be beleaguered on three sides. The fourth side would be gravely threatened. Hitler might attempt the investment first rather than an invasion of Britain. By concentrating fierce aerial bombing attacks on this island and on shipping, thereby trying a blockade, the German leader might hope to force the British people to surrender. German planes have daily dropped high explosives and incendiary bombs on various parts of the country during the past week. These raids have been more in the nature of reconnaissance. They are merely the advance notice of what is to come. But the bombing raids, whatever else they have achieved, have shown the high morale of the British people. Several mornings ago, I sat with a dozen others in the cellar of a country hotel. As German bombers passed overhead and the sirens wailed and anti-aircraft guns barked, for 3 hours, we sat into the early dawn, talking and drinking tea. An elderly lady confided in me that her Pekingese, named Dinky, must have had a premonition of an air raid because he had been slightly nervous all the previous evening. But they can't intimidate us, she said. Some played cards, One couple had brought their chessboard and pieces with them. That is the spirit of the moment. The morale is high. Hitler thinks he can break this morale by a blizzard of bombs from the air. Should investment and blockade and intimidation fail, Hitler would attempt invasion. But blockade is a long process. Hitler is in a hurry. Invasion is expected. The coastlines of England, Scotland, and Wales are extensive. Simultaneous attacks on a dozen or more points would, it is admitted, result in some landings. Hitler has been busy building in Norway, it is reported, a fleet of flat-bottomed boats to add to those already prepared for carrying tanks to invade British soil. Hitler is ready for heavy sacrifices and trying to force landings. The British are confident they can dispose of such landing forces and make it difficult for the Germans to maintain supplies to any units or columns that succeed in getting some distance inland. I think it is essential to say, first, the British will put up a terrific resistance. Second, they will have to do so, for they will face not only a determined and fanatic foe, but one with powerful weapons and equipment. The German attack must never at any stage be underestimated. Overconfidence or failure to give British troops the necessary supplies and immediate mobility of action would be unfortunate. Mobility of troop movement and sufficiency of guns are essential. Aerial support will play a dominant part. The RAF is the best air force in the world. But air superiority depends upon numbers, even if numbers may be modified by the quality of the airmen. Germany still maintains, especially with Italian entry into war, numerical air supremacy. There is belief in some quarters that Mussolini would like to take part in the attack on England. Just a little while ago, the Rome radio stated that the Italian High Command considers the time is right for an attack against the British forces, which have so far been protected by the neutrality of Egypt. The announcer added that the demilitarization of the frontier zones of the French Empire in North Africa, under the terms of the armistice, would give the Italians added advantage. Before long, we shall soon be seeing developments, they added. The French defeat has brought increased danger to the British position in the Near East. The adhesion of the French Syrian command to the Bordeaux government is a grave matter. Alexandria and the Suez Canal are vital points for British power. They are covered now by the British and Empire forces in Palestine, Transjordania, and Egypt. And any attempt by the Italians and Germans to create a diversion toward the Balkans and the Dardanelles might threaten one main source of British oil supply. It is reported from Spain, according to the German radio, that a German motorized division from France will visit the Spanish town of San Sebastian. This division might be handy if an attack on Gibraltar is contemplated. At any rate, the Germans safeguard the overland route over France from all the mineral resources from Spain. Japan, in the meanwhile, is losing no time to take advantage of British troubles. Hong Kong looms as a danger spot. The sudden return to Hong Kong of the United States line of President Coolidge, which left Sunday morning for Manila, is causing considerable speculation. It is presumed the ship has received instructions to remove Americans. Thus, pressures being brought at many strategic points of Britain and her far-flung empire. It is not only the battle for Britain, but the British outposts. I now take you back to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Back in the NBC newsroom after our report from London. We had expected to bring you a broadcast at this time from Ankara, Turkey, but the Turkish transmitter is not on the air at this time as we had hoped. Therefore, let's go to the nation's capital for a report from the home front. Let's listen to Balkage reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Balkage talking from Washington.
But the folks down here have become a little bit more loquacious in considering the aftermath of the Republican convention. And several ideas, at least, have begun to crystallize. And the war news, I can assure you, never gets very far into the background, even of these purely domestic political discussions. One idea seems to emerge, and that is that the chances that Mr. Roosevelt will accept the Democratic nomination seem to be greater than before. That implies, of course, that it will be offered to him, but I think that is a safe implication. And in this case, both the war and the convention are being given as the reasons for this feeling that Mr. Roosevelt will run again. The choice of Wendell Willkie makes it a challenge of personality. It is therefore personalized the whole campaign. The Republicans have chosen a colorful candidate, and he will need a colorful opponent. The convention also did something else besides choose a man who seems to have all the potentialities of a vote-getter regardless of issues, or rather that he has those qualities quite aside from what the issue may be. And this is what it showed. It showed the convention, I mean, and the attitude of the delegates showed how decidedly anti-war the great majority of the Middle West delegates were. Incidentally, I believe that it became very evident this time that the convention system has at least one great advantage. There may be a lot of faults with this system. It's been criticized in many ways and very frequently, but it certainly does this. It brings every section of the nation face to face with every other section. It Americanizes the whole group. It certainly is an excellent clearinghouse if the delegates wish to use it as such, a clearinghouse of ideas and viewpoints. It makes an Easterner realize that because he thinks one way, and that most of the people in his town do, it doesn't mean that the folks out on the prairies or the Pacific coast or the South think that same way. And it also reveals to him, if he's willing to ask a few questions and talk a little with the people from other parts of the country, why they think that way. It gives the Westerner or the Southerner a chance to see what the East is in terms of flesh and blood. Of ordinary human beings like himself that come from small towns the way he does, if he does. And it doesn't give him the impression of the East that the visitor simply gets from waiters and hotel clerks and cabaret entertainers. Of course, some of the delegates will be and are always so hidebound and so provincial that they don't get the benefit of these contacts with each other. But certainly, the general effect is noticeable. And it's an effect of Americanization and moving toward a single view and an attitude of compromises. At this convention, not only the Republicans, but the Democrats learned a lot from this anti-war attitude of the Middle West. You can call the Middle Western attitude provincial and narrow, if you have take the other side, or you can call the viewpoint of some of the Eastern delegates biased and un-American. But after all, both do represent America. They have ideas that they've formed naturally, and you have to take both into consideration. Of course, there are exceptions on both sides that prove the rule. You have a Hamilton Fish from the president's own Dutchess County in New York demanding an anti-war flank. And then you have a William Allen White of Kansas heading a committee to push further and further the aid of the Allies. And then, of course, there's the rank and file lining up on one side or the other. The administration, in this campaign that's coming, has a job before it of winning the Middle West to its side. And they don't have to sell them on the national defense. They know that. The response has been too great and too sympathetic with the president's program. But they do have to take into consideration, at least that's what some of the leaders are saying here today, the difficulty of drawing a line between defense and interventionism. And so that undoubtedly, too, may affect the president's attitude as to whether he wishes to run or not. There is still talk that the president, that Mr. Roosevelt, may accept the nomination with an understanding that he would serve only in case of and through an emergency. And then he'd resign and let the vice president take over. Well, that's why the presidential fight at Chicago is going to be interesting and exciting. And another thing seems to be pretty plain. The administration forces are going to try to prove to the country that the Wilkie boom was synthetic. At least that's the strategy, according to some who think they know what's going to happen. That they're going to prove, if they can, or try to prove, at least they're going to say that the publicity was carefully created by the interests that are backing Wilkie rather than a spontaneous outburst such as it seemed to be at the convention. Well, that's a pretty delicate job, too, for too much pressure of that kind would be very likely to have a reaction and might create a great deal of sympathy for Mr. Wilkie. It might make a martyr of him. Another delicate question, of course, which the administration has to deal with. It has nothing to do with the political situation, but which is being brought to a head by conditions in Europe, such as you have heard just now reported, for instance, from London. And that question is the job of creating here in this country this solid economic front against a possible totalitarian Europe. Some of you, I hope, heard Secretary of Agriculture Wallace today on the University of Chicago roundtable when he made his argument for a huge corporation for the handling of all Western Hemisphere surpluses, grains and fibers and so forth. Naturally, American farmers get a little nervous over the idea of supporting an organization to buy grains or fibers from South American countries when we can't sell all that we raise ourselves here. Secretary Wallace made a special point of that. He said that the surpluses of one American nation would not be dumped on another. And he said emphatically that money judiciously spent in this endeavor, that is, of trying to buy up the various supplies, would not only ensure peace, but it actually would ensure good prices in America, too, or at least it would do more than any other one thing, he said, any other way of spending money to ensure peace and bring about good prices in America. The idea is, of course, that if we do have a solid front, we can meet the economic demands of the totalitarian government which may be set up in France and the other countries which Hitler occupies, as he hopes to do, creating one great union. He has to have that food. If he can make better offers to some of the South American countries than could otherwise be made, he could get his economic penetration, which would be followed by political penetration, of course. If, on the other hand, we stand solidly together, all the Western Hemisphere, we'll be able to deal with him on even or better terms. All of this question that has come up now emphasizes the importance of Middle Western opinion and the necessity which both parties have of waking that opinion and appealing to the voters there. Congress is going to begin tomorrow on an active debate. They're going to consider adjournment by July 15th. And so we're going to look forward to activities beginning tomorrow early. That's all from Washington. Now we return you to the NBC newsroom. Back again in New York, after our report from Borkage in Washington, our engineers have been monitoring the wavelength of the Turkish station and still report that it is not on the air, so we must cancel our hopeful broadcast from Ankara this evening. Meanwhile, from the NBC newsroom, a dispatch on the Balkan situation. Several clashes between Russian and Romanian troops were revealed officially tonight by the Romanian High Command while the Red Army neared complete occupation of the surrendered province of Bessarabia and territory of northern Bukovina. King Carol simultaneously summoned Parliament to meet in extraordinary session Wednesday to hear a report on Romania's capitulations to the Soviet ultimatum and mobilization to defend herself against any further encroachments. In this program period, you've been listening to NBC's regular Sunday evening roundup of world news. Tonight you heard from Rome, Berlin, London, and Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.